Portugal. If only. Outside the tent flap, Jake barks.
Arsinoe, Ellis says. It's time.
Madrigal holds the young queen by the shoulders and gives her one steadying shake. When Jules arrives, she'll get the blood to me, and I will send the potion to the stage with her. It's all right. There is still time. Arsinoe steps out of the tent, and a lump lodges in her throat. Standing outside her tent are not only the Sandrins and Luke and the Malones, but half of the naturalists in the valley. What are they doing here? Arsinoe whispers to Joseph.
This, Joseph asks and smiles. Seems that someone heard rumor of your performance. Queen Arsinoe and her great brown bear.
And how did that happen?
Once Luke caught wind of it, the entire valley knew within an hour.
Arsinoe looks at the people. Some smile at her in the torchlight. Her whole life, they have thought her a failure. Yet at the first hint of hope, they move to follow her, as if it is what they wanted all along. Perhaps it was.
Queen Catherine's stage. The temple decreed the order of the quickening performances. Catherine is to be first. The priestesses have set the long mahogany table with the poisoner's feast. The torches are lit. She needs only to climb up onto her stage and begin. Catherine cranes her neck to view the crowd. The sea of faces and black-clad bodies stretches in front of all three stages and along the coast. Catherine's stage is in the middle. Directly before hers is a raised dais where the suitors sit, with High Priestess Luca.
So many priestesses, Natalia mutters from beside her.
Yes, Catherine says. Her stomach tenses. Natalia is a strong source of comfort, but she wishes that Peter had changed his mind about not attending.
All right, Cat, Natalia says.
Let us go.
They walk up together. Catherine smiles as luminously as she knows how, remembering not to look rigid and formal like her elemental sister. But still, the crowd's eyes on her are somber. When Mirabella takes her stage, no doubt they will grin like fools. Genevieve and Cousin Lucien stand in the front row. She nods to them, and for once, Genevieve does not scowl. Catherine and Natalia take their places at the head of the table.
Trust me, Natalia says. Say the words loud.
Catherine's gown rustles against her legs. It is a very fine garment to be ruined by Gave Noir stains. She can only hope that none of those stains will be caused by her sickening. Before them, priestesses remove the lids from each poison dish and announce the contents. Inky cat mushrooms stuffed with goat cheese and wolfsbane. Codfish stewed in yew berries. Tartlets of belladonna. Deathstalker scorpions, sugared and buttered, beside a dish of clotted oleander cream, and cantarella wine. The centerpiece of the feast is a great golden pie, baked into the shape of a swan. The air fills with delicious scents. The first three rows of poisoners lift their noses to scent the air like alley cats at a kitchen window.
Are you hungry, Queen Catherine? Natalia asks. And Catherine takes a breath.
I am ravenous. Natalia stands to one side as Catherine eats. Her bites at first are tentative and small, as if she does not believe. But as the feast progresses and the poisoners clap, she grows more confident. Pink-tinged sauce drips down her chin. The mainland boys on the dais wet their lips. What wonder they must feel. Watching this girl who cannot die. It does not even matter that it is not real. Catherine pushes away the plate of candied scorpions. She ate three, clever enough to leave the tails crumbled in the yellow sugar. All that remains is the swan pie. Natalia guides Catherine around the side of the table, and the queen tears through the crust to scoop out the meat. That is all. Catherine washes it down with a full goblet of wine
and empties it to the last drop. She slams her hands down on the table. The crowd cheers, louder, it seems, out of sheer surprise. Natalia raises her eyes to the dais and finds Luca's cold, stony gaze. Natalia smiles. Queen Arsinoe's stage. From her place behind the stage to Catherine's right, the Gave Noir looks as grotesque as Arsinoe expected a ritual feasting of poison to look. She is unfamiliar with many of the poisons listed in the dishes, but even she must admit to being impressed as pale, petite Catherine swallows them down. By the time it is over, Catherine is coated in berry glaze and meat gravy to the elbows, and the crowd is screaming. Arsinoe clenches her fists and then remembers the rune drawn in her palm and quickly releases them. It cannot be smudged or muddied. This is not the best day to ask her palms not to sweat. Arsinoe?
Jules! Thank the goddess!
Jules presses the small black bowl of potion into Arsinoe's hand. Arsinoe makes a face.
Pretend that it's wine, Jules says.
Arsinoe stares down into it. Drinking seems impossible. Though it is no more than four mouthfuls, it is four mouthfuls of salty, metallic, and tepid liquid. Blood from her own veins and the veins from a bear.
I think I see a piece of fur, Arsinoe says. Arsinoe, drink it!
She tips the bowl back until it knocks against the wood of her mask. The potion tastes just as bad as she feared. It is surprisingly thick, and the herbs and roses do not help, providing only unwanted texture and chewiness. Arsinoe's throat tries to close, but she manages to force it down, remembering to save enough to pool in the palm of her rune hand.
I'll be just beside the stage, says Jules, and disappears.
The priestesses announce Arsinoe, and she steps up. The eyes of the crowd are as heavy as they were atop the cliffs, but she cannot think about them now. Somewhere, not far away, a bear is waiting. She walks to the center of the stage, the hastily assembled boards creaking beneath her feet. The blood taste coats her tongue and rolls in her belly. She keeps her rune hand carefully cupped to her chest. It will work. It will look like she is praying, like she is calling for her familiar.
Here, bear, 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 Arsinoe mutters and closes her eyes.
For a few moments, all is silent. And then, he roars. People scream and part a wide path as he lopes toward the stage from the cover of the cliffs. He climbs up beside her without hesitation. The sight of his long, curved claws makes the cuts on her face itch. Somewhere to her right, Arsinoe hears Camden snarl and hiss. Arsinoe may not have long. Jules may not have much control. She has to get the blood and the rune pressed to his forehead. He comes closer. His fur touches her hip, and she freezes. His jaws are large enough to take half her ribcage in one bite.
Come,
she says, surprised that her voice does not crack. The bear turns his snout to look at her. His bottom lip hangs down, as bears' bottom lips do. His gums are mottled pink. There is a black spot on the tip of his tongue. Arsinoe reaches out and presses the bloody rune into the fur between the bear's eyes. She holds her breath. She stares into the bear's brown and gold-flecked eyes. The bear sniffs her face and slobbers on her mask, and Arsinoe laughs. The crowd cheers. Even those naturalists who doubted her throw their arms into the air. She ruffles the bear's brown fur and decides to push her luck a little further.
Come on, Jules, she says,
and raises her arms in a wide V.
Up!
The bear slides backward. Then he stands on his hind legs and bellows. The beach fills with cheers and shouts, the barking and cawing of happy familiars. Then the bear drops back onto all fours, and Arsinoe throws her arms around his neck and hugs him tight. The dais. The high priestess watches the girl embrace the bear and claps with the others. She has no choice. Amid the cheers and celebration, her eyes seek Ro, who faces her with eyes full of blood. Luca shakes her head. It is over. They have lost. Ro shakes her head. She bares her teeth and reaches for the handle of the knife at her side. Queen Mirabella's stage. No one expected such a showing from Catarine and Arsinoe, Sarah Westwood says as she adjusts the fall of Mirabella's cloak. But it does not matter. It is still you they have come to see. Mirabella cranes her neck toward where Catarine sits on her stage, in the middle of a poisoned table, and farther right, where Arsinoe stands, calmly stroking an enormous brown bear. She is not so sure that Sarah is correct, but she can only do what she can do. The drums start before the priestesses call her to the stage. They extinguish all the torches, so her stage is dark, except for the warm, red glow of one brazier. Mirabella climbs the steps in three fast strides. She throws aside her cloak, and the crowd hushes. The quiet is absolute. The drums beat faster in time with her pulse. She reaches for the fire, and it leaps onto her hands. A murmur passes through the crowd as the flames stretch up her arms and roll across her belly. Working the fire is slow and sensuous, more controlled than when she calls the wind and the storms. The flames are bright. They do not burn her, but her blood still feels like it is boiling. She spins. The crowd gasps, and fire crackles in her ears. In the midst of the people straining toward her is Joseph. Seeing him nearly makes her take a misstep. His face is the face he wore on the night they met, lit by flames on a darkened beach. How she longs to pull him up onto the stage. She would clothe them both in fire, burn them up together, rather than far apart. She throws her head back as he calls her name. Mirabella! Queen Catarine's stage. Natalia watches the girls spin, on fire. The crowd is a sea of blank, enthralled faces. Mirabella has them in the palm of her hand. Something is shifting in the many rows of priestesses that line the stages. Their fingers slip inside their cloaks to rest on the hilts of their knives. One priestess, with hair as red as blood, stares at Natalia with a gaze so intense that she has to look away. The strength of Mirabella's performance is difficult to believe. Even Natalia feels the pull, the draw to move toward her on the stage. She blinks and turns toward Luca and the old woman's dark, burning eyes. The ruses that Natalia and the naturalists carried off do not matter. The temple will not waver. They will make the sacrificial year come true. Queen Arsinoe's stage. Jules can hardly hold the bear and watch Mirabella dance at the same time. The noise and movement of the crowd make him nervous, and beside Arsinoe, he begins to bob his head and scratch at the boards. Jules refocuses. It is all right, she whispers, with beads of sweat upon her brow. And in her mind, the bear tugs. He tugs hard. The crowd surges toward Mirabella, and Jules grits her teeth. When will the girl be done? The dance feels like it has gone on forever, though the people do not seem to mind. Jules takes a deep breath and searches for Joseph. He will be somewhere, watching, proud of her for what she has done with the bear. Only, he is not looking at Jules at all. He is at the very front of Mirabella's stage, pressing toward her with the crowd. Jules can hardly believe the look in his eyes. If she were to shout his name at the top of her lungs, he would not hear her. He would not hear her if she were standing right beside his ear. The lust on his face sickens Jules's stomach. He has never looked at her the way he looks at Mirabella. In the midst of her dance, Mirabella reaches toward Joseph through the flames. Everyone can see. They must all know that they are together, that Jules is a fool. In her chest, Jules's heart turns sharp as a shard of glass, and something snaps. As it does, so does her hold on the bear. Arsinoe knows that something is wrong when the bear starts shaking his head. His eyes change from serene to frightened and then to angry. She steps back. Jules, she says, but when she tries to get Jules's attention, she cannot. Jules is staring intently toward Mirabella's stage like everyone else. The bear paws the wooden boards. Easy, Arsinoe says, but she can do nothing. The low magic that binds them is not the same as a familiar bond. The bear is afraid, and Jules has lost control. There is no time to warn anyone, as he roars and leaps from the stage and into the people, swiping sharp claws and throwing his head back and forth. No one can scatter. They are crowded together too tightly as they strain for Mirabella's stage. Not even his claws cutting them down parts enough of a path, and the bear turns back for the stages. Jules! Arsinoe shouts. But her shout is lost within the rest as the crowd begins to realize what is happening. The bear climbs onto the middle stage, and Catherine screams. He barrels through the table of the Gave Noir, dashing it to pieces and sending it tumbling down to the sand. But he does not make it to Catherine. She is quick and dives off the side to safety. Priestesses draw their knives and advance with terrified faces. The bear slashes at the nearest one, and her white robes do nothing to hide all the red and loops of entrails that its claws rake out of her. At the sight of so much blood, the courage of the others fails, and they turn to flee with the crowd. High Priestess Luca stands and shouts. The suitors watch in horror. On the far stage, Mirabella has stopped dancing, but fire still burns across her chest and hips. It does not take the bear long to focus on her. He charges, tearing down torches and anyone who happens to be in his way. Mirabella cannot move. She cannot even scream. Joseph leaps onto the stage, right in the bear's path. He covers Mirabella with his body. No, Arsinoe says, no! Jules must know that is Joseph. She must see. But it may be too late to call the bear back. Queen Mirabella's stage. Priestesses shout to protect the queen, but all Mirabella hears is the bellowing of the bear. All she feels are Joseph's arms around her. The bear did not strike them. It reared up on its hind legs. It roared. But in the end, it pawed at its face as though in pain, and then dived off the stage to run down the beach. Mirabella lifts her head and looks down at the scattered, panicked crowd. Most have found their way to safety through the cliffs and back into the valley, but several bodies lie motionless before the stages. The young priestess who attended Catherine's stage lies now at the foot of it, her arms bent, her robes and her abdomen laid open for all to see. And so many more have been wounded. Are you all right? Joseph whispers into her ear. Yes, she says and clings to him. He kisses her hair and her shoulder. White-robed priestesses surround them with knives drawn.
Calm yourselves,
Luca shouts, standing on the dais beside two shaky suitors.
It has gone.
Mirabella peers over Joseph's arm at the ruined stages. Arsinoe stands alone, her arms fluttering at her sides. Perhaps she did not realize the extent of the carnage she would cause. She sent that bear for me, Mirabella says. After everything I did to save her, she would have let it tear me apart if not for you. It doesn't matter,
Joseph says, "You're safe. You're all right." He holds her face in his hands. He kisses her.
"Where is Queen Catherine?" Natalia Aaron shouts. "Luca, where is she?"
"Do not panic," says the High Priestess. "We will find her. She is not amongst the fallen."
Natalia looks around wildly, perhaps to form her own search party, but all her poisoners have fled. Moans erupt from the foot of her stage and she grimaces. The bear knocked the Gave Noir off the edge, at the foot of the crowd. The poisoned food lies dashed across the sand. Several dog familiars lap eagerly at it.
"They have eaten some," a woman weeps. "Stop them! Call them back!"
Natalia steps quickly to the front. "Isolate the food," she orders, her composure regained and her voice even and deep. "The dogs must be brought to my tent for treatment, quickly. Gather them up and keep the rest of them clear." Across the stages, Arsinoe retreats in the company of the Malones. The mask she wears makes any expression unreadable.
"How could she?" Mirabella asks, heartbroken.
But even to her ears, it seems a foolish question for a queen to ask. Joseph shushes her as he kisses her hair.
"Away from her now, naturalist." Ro reaches out and drags Joseph back without effort.
He does not struggle much when he sees the serrated knife in her hand.
"Leave him alone, Ro," Mirabella says. "He saved me."
"From his own queen's attempt," Ro says.
She jerks her head, and three more priestesses come forward to lead Joseph away. Ro grabs Mirabella by the arm. Her fingers dig in deep until Mirabella yelps.
"Back to your tent now, my queen. The quickening is over. The ascension year has begun."
The Breccia Domain. Branches scrape at Catherine's face as she runs through the trees in the southern woods. Her heart pounds, and her knee throbs from when she fell against the stage. She falls again when her skirt twists in a bramble. With no torch, she has only the light of the moon as a guide, and there is not much of that deep in the trees.
"Peter?"
she calls, weak and breathless. She did as she was told and ran straight from the quickening to the five-sided tent and into the woods beyond.
"Peter!"
"Catherine!"
He steps out from behind a tree, holding a small lamp aloft. She stumbles to him, and he catches her against his chest.
"I do not know what happened," she says. "It was so awful."
The bear would have killed her, split her open just like it had that poor priestess. It will be a long time before she can forget the crazed look in its eyes and the sharp, wild arc of its claws.
"I hoped it would not come true," Peter says. "I hoped that Natalia was right, that she had it under control. I am so sorry, Cad."
She rests her head on his shoulder. He was kind to meet her here, away from everyone, for a few moments of solace. His arms take the chill from her skin, and the strange, deep earth smell of the Breccia Domain calms her as she breathes it in. Peter rocks her back and forth. He steps with her slowly until it is almost like dancing, and their feet slide across the smooth surface of the rock at the sides of the crevasse.
"Perhaps I should have stayed with Natalia," Catherine says. "She could be hurt."
"Natalia can take care of herself," says Peter. "She is not the one in danger. You did the right thing."
"They will be coming for me soon. Looking. We do not have long."
Peter kisses the top of her head.
"I know," he says regretfully. "The bloodthirsty temple."
"What?"
"I was not supposed to love you, Cat."
He takes her face in his hands.
"But you do?"
"Yes," he says, and kisses her. "I do."
"I love you too, Peter," says Catherine.
Peter steps back. He holds her gently by the shoulders.
"Peter?"
she asks.
"I am sorry," he says. And then he throws her down, down, down into the bottomless pit of the Breccia Domain. The Ascension Year begins. The Aran Encampment. A day and a half after the disaster of the Quickening, Innisfil Valley is nearly empty. The naturalists and the elementals have gone. So have the giftless and those few with the war gift. Even most of the poisoners have returned to their homes, except for the Arans and those families most loyal to them. Many priestesses still remain, including High Priestess Luca, as they organize search parties and scour the cliffs for Catarine. But they have searched the entire valley, the shore and the forest on all sides. Poor Peter has searched non-stop since Catarine disappeared. But they have found no body and no answers. Natalia sits in her tent, alone. She has not searched since yesterday, and the longer the search goes on, the less she wants to find her. Today, the body would still be Catarine. But soon it would bloat and then decay. Natalia does not know if she can bear to find Catarine's little bones, held together by sinew and a rotted black dress. She drops her head into her hands, too tired to stand. Certainly too tired to take down tents and return to Indrid Down. To face the council and pretend that there is anything left for her to do. The tent flap opens, and High Priestess Luca walks inside in her white robe and black collar. Natalia straightens, but it cannot be news of Catarine. If it were, Luca would have sent someone to fetch her, instead of coming by herself, with no escort. High Priestess, says Natalia, please come in. Luca half turns and makes sure that the tent flap is closed. Then she raises her nose and sniffs. This tent, Natalia, it smells like dying dogs. Natalia purses her lips. The familiar hounds brought to her after the quickening died messily. There was no time to assemble a tidy poison. She used what she had on hand, and they convulsed and vomited on the rugs and pillows. Luca takes down the hood of her robes and unfastens her collar, showing off a wrinkled neck and fine, bright white hair. I must depart soon, she says, for Roland and Mirabella. Must, Natalia says with bitterness. A small contingent of priestesses will remain here. They will search until the little queen is found. For a moment, the two women regard each other. Then Natalia gestures to the chair opposite her at the small table. Luca snaps her fingers and has a pot of tea brought in. When they are settled and alone again, she sighs and leans back wearily. One of the delegations has fled, Luca says. The dark one, with the red flower in his jacket. His family was superstitious. They said this generation was cursed. This was not a terribly successful Beltane, says Natalia, and Luca laughs once. If only we had taken that brat's head and arms when we had the chance. If only your Mirabella had let us. Luca adds cream and two lumps of sugar to her tea and sets a thin baked biscuit on her plate. There is no poison in it, Luca says wryly of the tea. Perhaps you can squeeze that snake of yours into your cup. Natalia smirks and then sips. What can be done about Arsinoe? Natalia asks. What about her? She attacked the queens before the end of the quickening, before the ascension year had begun. It is a crime, is it not? A violation by a day? It was a show of strength, whether we like it or not. The people will push back if we punish her publicly. What good is the temple if it cannot enforce its own laws? Natalia grumbles. Indeed, says Luca. She takes a sip of tea and eyes Natalia over the rim of her cup. That lovely Gave Noir that you set, she says. All that poison fallen into the sand. I snuck a bit of it into one of my priestesses' dinner. And, oh! Luca's face lights up briefly. She lived. She did not even sicken. Unlike those poor dogs you dispatched. What did you give them, Natalia? Arsenic?
Natalia drums her fingers against the table. The High Priestess raises an eyebrow.
Do not whine about our weakness now, says Luca, when we are only what you have made of us, when it is you who have turned the people away.
If the people turn away from your preaching, then it is not our fault. We have never sought to impose council will on the temple.
No, says Luca, only to silence our voice.
She studies Natalia quietly. They have been adversaries for many years, but have spent little time alone together, and never when they were not battling over something.
It is strange, Luca says, that you have turned away from the goddess, when she is the one who creates the queens, whose power on this island preserves our way of life. I know, she says when Natalia rolls her eyes, you think it is you, the strength of your gift that keeps us safe. But who do you think gave that to you? She is the source of this thing you revere, yet you do not revere her. In your pride, you forget that she has given, and that she is the one who may take it away.
Roland. Looking out the window of the bouncing coach, the streets of Rolanth are strangely quiet. The city expected Mirabella to return in triumph. Now that she is not, there is an air of loss. Shops in the central district have pulled down most of the Beltane decorations, though a few modest ribbons and wreaths remain. She was not exactly beaten, after all. Her quickening performance was nearly a success. Nearly. But thanks to Arsinoe, she had not even gotten to finish. It will not be long until they are safely back at Westwood House, though it will not be the same as it once was. Now that Catherine is missing and presumed dead, the temple will take a defensive position until it is determined what happened. Ro will have a small army near Mirabella night and day. Already armed priestesses surround the coach, as well as Sarah and Uncle Miles's coach ahead of them. Mirabella doubts that Arsinoe will launch another attack so soon, but the temple will be ready for anything. I froze when that bear charged, Mirabella whispers, and Bree and Elizabeth raise their heads from where they rest against the windows. At first I thought it was a mistake, but it came right for me. Her friends look down, sadly. They will not tell her that Arsinoe did not mean it, and she does not want them to. She has had days to relive that terror, and for the hurt in her heart to turn to anger. Perhaps Arsinoe also murdered Catherine. Perhaps she had some other creature waiting for her when she ran away into the woods. Sweet little Catherine, who she and Arsinoe used to swear to protect. Elizabeth, Mirabella says, you are a naturalist. Could you have done what Arsinoe did with that bear? Elizabeth shakes her head. Never. Not with 50 of me. She is stronger than any naturalist I have ever seen. Or even heard of, Bree says with wide eyes. Mira, what will we do? If it were not for that boy, Joseph, you would be dead. Mirabella told them, afterward, who Joseph was and what happened between them. It came out in a rush, in her tent, when she was heartbroken in so many ways. Betrayed by Arsinoe and dragged away from Joseph, possibly forever. Dear Joseph, Elizabeth says, his love for you may save you again. If he is truly Arsinoe's good friend, perhaps he will stop her. Perhaps he will help us. I will not ask him to take sides, Mirabella says. But someone will. Arsinoe or Luca? I don't think that someone as strong as Arsinoe will hesitate to use her advantages. That is good, Mirabella says. I do not want her to hesitate,
I want her to push me and push me until I hate her.
She looks back out the window to escape the knowing sadness in Bree's and Elizabeth's eyes. They knew it would come to this. Everyone knew, except for Mirabella. But she is through being sentimental. Seeing that bear and Arsinoe's cold face behind that mask showed her the truth. The sisters she loved at the Black Cottage are gone. Arsinoe saw her chance and she took it. So next time, Mirabella will take hers as well.
Greavesdrake Manor. After a week of searching, Peter traveled back to Greavesdrake with Natalia. But once they arrived, he would not stay. Without Catherine, there was nothing for him there. Natalia did not try to convince him otherwise. The boy was miserable. Even his dull country house was preferable to Greavesdrake, haunted by Catherine's ghost. Before he left, they had one last drink together in her study. "You had me so convinced about the sacrificial year and the temple," he said. "I thought they were going to take her head. I did not even think of Arsinoe." Now he is gone, packed into a carriage, and Natalia is again alone. Genevieve and Antonin went directly to their houses in town, fearful of her mood. They would not dare return without an invitation. The servants, too, refused to look her in the eye. It would be nice if any of them were decent enough to pretend that everything was all right. Natalia walks down the main hall and listens to the spring wind rattle branches against the windows. The manor feels drafty this year. She will need workmen from the capital to inspect the windows and doors. It may not be hers for much longer, but she will not let the grand old house fall into disrepair. In the long red hallway that attaches to the staircase to her bedroom, she notes dust on the sconces and a small stack of clothing, folded and set just inside the door to the hall bath. She stoops over to pick it up and stops. She is not alone. There is a girl standing in the foyer. Her dress is a ruin, and her hair knotted and twisted through with filth. She does not move. She could have been standing there for a very long time. "Cat?" Natalia asks. The figure does not respond. As Natalia walks closer, she begins to fear that it is a figment of her imagination, that her mind has fractured, and at any moment the girl will vanish or dissolve into a pile of lice. Natalia reaches out, and Catherine looks up into her eyes. "Catherine," Natalia says, and crushes the girl to her chest. It is Catherine, dirty and cold, but alive. Cuts mar every inch of her skin. Her mangled hands hang limp by her sides, tipped in dark red, with most of the fingernails torn off. "I did not fall," Catherine croaks. Her voice is rough, as though her throat is filled with grave dirt. "We must get you warm," Natalia says. "Edmund, bring blankets and run a bath." "I do not want that," says Catherine. "What do you mean, sweetheart? What do you want?" "I want revenge," she whispers, and her fingers trail bloody streaks down Natalia's arms. "And then I want my crown." Wolf Spring. Though the townspeople would like to see her, Arsinoe spends her time in the Malone house or down in the orchard. She is not hiding, exactly, but it is easier there, where no one stares with newfound respect, and where she does not have to explain where her bear is. Telling the people that the bear was not actually her familiar will be difficult. They may be impressed by her ruse, but they will still be disappointed that she will not be riding it into town. "Are you accepting visitors?" Billy asks, walking up from the orchard. "Junior," she says, and he smiles. He has recovered from their time in the mist, at sea, and looks very well in a light brown jacket. With the young leaves stuck to his shoulder, he hardly looks like a mainlander at all.
I have never heard you sound so glad to see me, he says.
I wasn't sure you were still here. I thought your father might have packed you up and sailed you home.
No, no, Billy says. I am to begin formally courting soon, just like the other suitors. He's a dogged man, my father. He does not give up. You'll come to know that about him.
He holds out his hand. In it is a box, wrapped in blue paper and tied with green and black ribbon.
He sent this, you see, as a peace offering.
He shrugs.
It isn't much. Sweets from our favorite shop back home. Chocolates, dipped nuts, a few taffies. I thought you would like it, though, since you are mostly stomach.
A gift? Really? Arsinoe says and takes the box. I guess the bear changed his mind about me.
It changed everyone's minds about you.
He sighs and then nods to the house.
How are things here?
Arsinoe frowns. Since the quickening, Jules has been miserable. She has barely spoken to anyone. Joseph walks up behind Billy with his hands in his pockets. The look upon his face is grim and determined.
What are you doing here? Arsinoe asks.
I'm here to see Jules. I need to talk to her about what happened.
You need to grovel, is more like, to both of us.
To both of you? He asks, confused.
She must really be something, Arsinoe says. That elemental sister of mine, to make you forget every promise that you ever made, to Jules and to me.
Arsinoe,
do you want me to die now, instead of her? Would that make you happy?
She shoves past him hard on the way to the house. There is plenty more she would like to say to Joseph, but it is only right that Jules should have her turn first.
Let me put these away, she says, and shakes the candy box, and then I'll go find her for you.
It does not take long to find Jules walking in one of the southern fields with Alice discussing the spring plant. When Jules sees her, her face falls, as if she knows.
You have to talk to him sometime, Arsinoe says.
Do I? Says Jules.
Alice puts a gentle hand on his granddaughter's shoulder and walks back down the rows, holding Jake in his arm. The little white spaniel has scarcely walked a step since Beltane. Alice is just so grateful that he was not taken by the poison, like those unlucky familiars who ate from the fallen Gave Noir. Jules lets Arsinoe walk her around to the front of the house, where Joseph and Billy wait. Arsinoe takes Billy by the elbow and leads him away so Jules and Joseph can have some privacy.
All right, says Jules. Let's talk.
Jules lets Joseph inside the bedroom she shares with Arsinoe and closes the door softly in Camden's face. She does not know what will be said or how angry she will get, but if Camden were to injure him, she may regret it later. Outside, Joseph had seemed tense but collected, as if he had rehearsed many times whatever dressing down he intended to give her. Inside, he shrinks. He looks at her bed, where they spent so many moments together.
How could you do it? He asks softly. How could you send that bear?
I stopped it, didn't I? Jules snaps. And that's what you have come here to say? To accuse me? Not to tell me you're sorry for falling in love with someone else?
Jules, people died.
She turns away. She knows that. Does he think she is stupid? It all happened so fast. One moment she had the bear, and the next. It was the most difficult thing she had ever done, bringing him back under control. But she could not let him hurt Joseph. She leans against the writing desk and pushes a wrapped blue box.
What is this? She asks.
Billy brought it for Arsinoe, he says. It's a box of sweets.
Jules tugs off the lid. She does not have much of a taste for sweets, certainly not like Arsinoe does.
He chose well, she says.
Jules, answer the question. Why did you do it?
I didn't, she cries. I didn't mean to let him go. I had him.
until I watched her dance, until I saw you and the way you looked at her, like you have never looked at me.
Joseph's shoulders slump. That is not true, he says. I have looked at you. I see you, Jules. I always have.
Not like that, Jules says. In her mind, she sees the bear, charging. She does not know whether she would have stopped it from killing Mirabella. She only remembers the rage and the hurt and how her world turned red.
Jules reaches into the box of candy and puts a piece into her mouth. It tastes like nothing, but at least he cannot ask any more questions while she chews.
The night of the disembarking, she whispers, in my tent, when you wouldn't touch me. It was because of her, wasn't it?
Yes.
He says it so simply. One word, as if it requires no further explanation, no justifications, as if it does not make Jules's head begin to spin.
Do you not love me anymore, then?
Did you ever?
She pushes away from the writing desk and stumbles, her stomach weak and pained.
I've been quite an idiot, haven't I?
No, Joseph says.
Jules blinks. Her vision goes black and bright and then black again. Her legs go numb below her knee.
Jules, I...
Joseph, she says, and her voice makes him look up. He reaches out and grabs her to his chest as she falls. Joseph, she says. Poison.
His eyes grow wide. They flash to the box of sweets as Jules begins to fade, and he screams for Kate and Ellis.
It's my fault, Joseph says. Shut your mouth, Arsinoe says. How can it be your fault?
They sit beside Jules's bed, as they have since the healers left. They could do nothing, they said, but watch and wait for the poison to paralyze her lungs or her heart. Kate threw them out after that. She threw them out and wept for hours, bent over the kitchen table.
Damn it, where is Madrigal?
Joseph grasps Camden's fur, where she lies atop Jules's legs.
She can't handle it, Arsinoe says. But she knows where Madrigal is, gone to the bent-over tree to pray and make bargains of blood magic, gone to beg for her daughter.
Ellis knocks softly and pokes his head in.
Arsinoe, the mainlander is outside, asking for you.
Arsinoe stands and wipes at her eyes.
Don't leave her, Joseph.
I won't, he says. I'll never, never again.
In the yard, Billy waits with his back to the house. He turns when he hears her, and for a moment, she thinks he will try to hug her, but he does not.
I didn't know, Arsinoe. You have to believe me, I didn't.
I know that, Arsinoe says.
His face floods with relief.
I'm so sorry, he says. Will she be all right?
I don't know. They don't think so.
Billy slips his arms around Arsinoe, slowly and tentatively, as though she might bite. She probably would bite if he did not feel so solid and good to lean on.
They'll all pay for this, she says against his shoulder. They will bleed and scream and get what they're owed.
2 days after Jules was poisoned, she opens her eyes. Arsinoe is so exhausted that she is not sure whether she is hallucinating until Camden climbs onto Jules's chest and licks her face. Madrigal wails with joy. Ellis kneels beside the bed and prays. Kate sends her crow, Eva, out after the healers again. Joseph can only weep and press Jules's hand to his cheek. Arsinoe carries another pot of flowers from Joseph into their bedroom and sets them on the windowsill. There is almost not enough room. So many offerings crowd the space that it is beginning to look like a hothouse. As she arranges the blossoms, a few of the buds open with pert little clicks. She turns to Jules, sitting up against her pillows.
Feeling better, are we? Arsinoe asks.
I just wanted to see if I still could, Jules says. Of course you can. You will always be able to.
She walks to the bed and sits, scratching Camden's haunches. Jules looks much better today. Finally strong enough, perhaps, to hear what Arsinoe has been dying to tell her.
What? Jules asks. What is it?
You look like Camden after she has gotten into the eggs. Arsinoe peers down the hallway. The house is empty. Kate and Ellis are in the orchard, and Madrigal is in town with Matthew.
I have to tell you something, Arsinoe says, about the candy.
What? Is it about Billy? Did he do it?
No. I don't know. I don't think so.
She swallows and looks at Jules with bright eyes.
I ate it too.
Jules stares at her, confused.
When I put the box on the desk, Arsinoe says, before I came to get you in the field, I ate three of them, two chocolates and a taffy.
Arsinoe,
when have you known me to turn away candy?
I don't understand, says Jules.
Neither did I, Arsinoe says, not at first. You were so sick, and Joseph said you only ate one. And I was so worried about you that for a while, I didn't think about it at all. But then you woke up, and I knew.
Arsinoe leans forward on her elbows.
I haven't been a giftless queen all this time, Jules. Unable to sprout a beanstalk or turn a tomato red or get some stupid bird to sit on my shoulder.
Her voice grows louder and faster until she catches herself and quiets.
All this time, I thought I was nothing. But I'm not nothing, Jules.
Arsinoe looks up and smiles.
I'm a poisoner.
This is Amy Landon. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Three Dark Crowns by Kendara Blake. This program was produced by Literati Audio. The director was Dennis Kao. Executive producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2016 by Kendara Blake. Production copyright 2016 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.